Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Finally saying ciao to one of the big three. And I mean the goodbye kind of ciao. Plus, imagine work without any bosses. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Thursday, January 2nd. It's good to have you with us. Well, you may have had a good New Year's holiday, but was it as festive as Sergio Marchionne's? The CEO of Fiat and Chrysler finished up something he's wanted to do for a while: buy the remainder of Chrysler in a $4.3 billion deal. Italian carmaker Fiat took a stake in Chrysler back in the 2009 deal masterminded by the Obama administration, but now Fiat will control all of the once iconic American brand. So should Chrysler brace for a consumer backlash here in the U.S.? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith went to find out how much Made in America matters anymore.
As it turns out, we like to see stars, then stripes, when we shop. Jonathan Asher is with Perception Research Services. In a recent survey, it found three-quarters of shoppers were more likely to buy something because it was made in America.
What they tell us is it's a concern for the economy. You know, they want to support jobs at home and that sort of thing.
Last year, Walmart launched a local product push. It will buy an additional $50 billion worth of U.S.-made goods over the next decade. A company spokesman said surveys showed Made in the USA was very important to Walmart shoppers. It also tends to be important to car shoppers. Ira Kolb is a marketing professor at USC's Marshall School of Business.
For some reason, automobile brands really get associated with the country that originated them.
But where things are made isn't so simple, especially when it comes to cars, says Michael Robinette of IHS Automotive.
The Japanese, Korean, as well as German manufacturers are increasingly building more and more of their product sold in North America, in North America.
Still, people aren't logical when it comes to brand loyalty, or backlash, says USC's Ira Kolb.
Brand is a funny thing. It exists in the mind, and in marketing, that's what we do. We're sort of doing non-invasive brain surgery.
A little brand surgery may be in order for Chrysler, says Kolb. He says the company will need to address the fact it's no longer American, especially with older consumers who tend to care more about where things are made and tend to have more money to buy those things. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
IBM ended last year with this sad-sounding distinction. Its stock was the only one on the Dow Jones Industrial Average to lose value in 2013. The average as a whole, up 26%. IBM, down 2%. But the company actually looks a lot healthier than its stock performance suggests. It made money and paid dividends, and in the fast-changing tech world, it's got some big advantages. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story.
One of IBM's biggest advantages is being big, and being one of the companies big companies can rely on to take care of all their IT needs. Chief information officers for Fortune 500 companies, not big risk takers. If I got IBM, I got a guy.
And I have one throat to choke. And so if my guy messes up, I know exactly who to call.
That's Grady Burkett at Morningstar. All that integration means if you're IBM's customer, switching to another vendor isn't like trading your PC for a Mac. It's more like getting a divorce. IBM does its best to stay current. Cloud computing, which allows customers to rent server space instead of buying them from vendors like IBM, is eating into its sales, so IBM's playing catch-up by buying up companies that provide cloud services. Andrew McAfee wrote the book Enterprise 2.0. He's a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Business. He thinks IBM's star turn on TV a couple of years ago was a good sign.
Watson? Nonfiction. For 1600.
IBM did not build Watson just to play Jeopardy.
No, it built Watson to compete with Google Search and Apple's Siri.
Think about it, applied to troubleshooting, applied to customer service, applied to medical diagnostics. The potential uses for a Watson-style technology are all over the place.
And the stock? Josh Olson is an analyst at Edward Jones.
You know, we think over that, you know, sort of longer time horizon, that these fundamentals will start to shine through more, and that will be reflected in the stock price.
In other words, the fast-moving stock market may yet catch up with this big, mature company. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not a hot start to the trading year. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Conventional wisdom has held that patients with health insurance are less likely to wind up in the emergency room. But a new study turns that thinking on its head, showing that people with Medicaid in Oregon were more likely to use the ER than those without insurance. It's a highly charged political issue. The Obama administration announced this week that nearly 4 million Americans took steps to sign up in October and November for Medicaid coverage. That number's expected to grow as more people sign up for the ACA. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
In health policy circles, there's a widely espoused theory. Amitaj Chandra is a health economist at Harvard.
If we insure the uninsured, they're not going to use the emergency room and they're going to use less health care. So in the long run, insuring the uninsured saves us money.
Obamacare advocates have used this argument to say insurance should be expanded. There's just one thing. That's not what happens.
It's basic economics that I would teach my students, which is when you lower the price of something, people buy more of it. That's true of apples and bananas, and it turns out it's true of, you know, of healthcare too.
That's MIT economist Amy Finkelstein, one of the report's authors, who explains in Oregon, the ER is free if you have Medicaid. What she and her team found is that people on Medicaid use the emergency room 40% more than people without insurance. But it's not just ER use that's up. Co-author Catherine Baker says it's primary care, preventive care, prescription drugs.
That doesn't mean that's inefficient, good or bad. It just means that insurance makes healthcare more affordable, and that has both financial consequences and health consequences.
Based on this report, there are already estimates that increased ER use will cost taxpayers $500 million a year. This is the very definition of a political football, which is why details in this report matter. First, nearly 60% of all the people on Medicaid in the study didn't go to the ER at all over 18 months. Second, when people with private insurance were given more generous private health coverage, their health use went up too. And perhaps most important, Harvard's Amitaj Chandra says when it comes to money, this isn't where the action is.
The spending is not in the emergency room. The spending is on high-cost patients. These are cancer patients, many of them in the end of life.
With this report in hand, Chandra says it's easy to argue whether the ACA will bankrupt the country. The big question, the tough question, is how to limit care everyone agrees is inefficient and expensive, regardless of who gets it or where that care is received. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
All this week, we've been asking our correspondents to reflect on their beats and think about what are likely to be the big stories in 2014. Today, we're talking with our technology reporter, Queena Kim, about what happened in 2013 and, more importantly, how it will color the new year. She joins me from San Francisco. Hey, Queena.
Hey.
So we asked you to look ahead to 2014 and think about sort of a framework for the year. What'd you pick for us?
Well, mine is the idea of fallout and uncertainty, and that comes from, you might have guessed, the Edward Snowden leaks and all the news that we've been hearing about the NSA. I think this was a year where, you know, we sort of found out what it meant for the general population and the degrees to whether people were freaked out or not. This year's probably going to be like, what is the fallout going to be for these tech companies and the uncertainty that's creating?
So we saw all of these big companies, Apple, Facebook, Google, Twitter, they've taken out these big ads in newspapers saying they're advocating for reform of government surveillance practices. But, you know, if the NSA is doing things without their knowledge, if they're putting backdoors into their software or if they're tapping fiber optic cables, what kind of leverage do companies actually have here? Do they have any?
I mean, I think that's, you know, sort of touching on this whole thing of uncertainty. One of the things we do know is that a lot of these companies have come out saying that they're going to put in extra measures like, you know, encrypting their emails, as well as trying to figure out a way to make sure that the information going from server to server is secure. And I don't want to get too much into the nitty gritty, but they're trying to up their game. Of course, it's just a matter of time before the NSA ups their game and it becomes this arms race. And the question, I guess, there is who starts paying for you know, all these security measures. I have a feeling somehow they're going to be passed down to us, the consumers.
I want to focus on another episode that's generating headlines, which is the Snapchat hack. Are we getting to a point where the passwords that we use daily for all of these different apps just aren't that secure? And we think of this as maybe a cost of doing business that, meh, these things just get hacked and then we change them and it's just not that important anymore?
You know, there have been so many of these breaches. Consumers don't seem to care. We're not seeing them like, you know, I got breached with Facebook and I didn't stop using Facebook. And I imagine there's tons of people like me. So I wonder if there is a calculation on the business side as to, you know, this is just the price of doing business. And the price isn't that high because consumers aren't really voting by walking away.
On the other hand, that's not your online banking.
That's true. And maybe there's different tiers in terms of like, I just use a generic one for all the things I don't really care if people hack into. And then I use like more secure passwords for like banking and things that like, obviously I don't want people to know.
So we get to watch fallout and uncertainty as 2014 keeps going. Queena Kim, our tech reporter in San Francisco, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, to understand the GED, you need to understand who it was created for.
From now on, the last word out of your mouth is sir. Do you understand?
Sir, yes, sir!
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street sobered up pretty fast on this first trading day of 2014. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 135 points. That's 0.8% to close at 16,441. The NASDAQ fell 33 points, also 0.8%, ending at 4143. And the S&P 500 lost 16 points, another 0.8% to close at 1831. Apple sliced off 1.4% after an analyst downgraded the stock. Sprint also suffered a downgrade, and it dropped 3.25%. European markets were also down. The German DAX slid down more than 1.5%. The French CAC 40 slipped 1.6%. London FTSE fell more than 0.4%. In Tokyo, the Nikkei climbed 0.7%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell below 3% to 2.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. Was there a new car under the tree? Automakers are scheduled to report December sales. A 49th star was added to the American flag when Alaska was admitted to the Union on January 3, 1959. And January is Be Kind to Food Servers Month. But you probably aren't eating out anyway. I mean, not after all that holiday celebration. Wait, that wasn't just me, right? I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Zappos, the online shoe company, is trying a new management experiment, something called Holacracy, where there aren't really job titles or managers, and everyone works for the company's mission. They're still figuring out some details, like who determines pay, but it's a pretty dramatic change for the 1,500 people who work there. Historian Nancy Kane joins us from Harvard Business School, as she does every couple of weeks. Welcome back, Nancy.
Always a pleasure, Lizzie.
Zappos has a reputation for being a pretty happy place to work, a pretty innovative company.
Yeah.
Why throw out a rule book that seems to be working pretty well?
I think the best time to change is actually when you're at the top, at the crest of the wave. The organizational structures that grew up, if you will, with industrialization, that those structures now are rapidly becoming outdated by the pace and nature and energy of business in the early 21st century. So some of this, I think, is about Zappos trying to stay ahead.
Most people think about going to work, maybe having a boss, their boss has a boss, pretty traditional structure. What might a holacracy look like, even a modified one? Or are there companies that we can look at now and say, is there a playbook to follow here?
So there aren't a lot of large companies that I know of that have come, you know, bought into this playbook. The closest analog I can think of is, you know, a sort of early stage, but not just out of the birth canal startup company. Startup companies work like little villages. Everyone pitches in. Everyone is responsible for solving the next problem or putting out the next bonfire. And there's very little attention and very little formal structure around things like job titles, you know, the purview of one's responsibility, you know, how one is measuring up. And you know, again, here we see something very interesting, very, very rife with potential, but also that presents a whole bunch of interesting questions like, you know, promotions and salaries and development and training. And what about the people in every single office who are the doubting Thomases, who whine and complain and are difficult and who have to be dealt with? And what about the superstars?
Because everybody's office has maybe got a jerk in it, and someone's got to tell that jerk to stop being a jerk.
And someone has to manage the jerk and dial down the costs of the jerk, right? I've yet to encounter any organization in 20 years of studying and working with organizations that didn't have some of those doubting Thomases.
You know, 10, 15 years ago, open plan offices were sort of all the rage among executives rethinking office structure. Do you think rethinking the organizational chart is a new fad among executives? Is this kind of where workplace structure is going?
I think that open offices were the opening salvo in, again, a growing consensus among executives that we need a different way to put ourselves together. This is a much, much bigger, right, set of gunfire or set of initiatives coming across the bow here. This is saying, you know, how we report to each other, who we sit with, what we do each day, what we consider important, all that's going to be different. And we're going to place a big, big bet on that revolution.
Yeah, doesn't that mean the CEO might have to give up a little bit of power?
Absolutely. He's going to have to, he or she, if, you know, someday there may be a female Zappos CEO, they're going to have to give up some of the gold and some of the scepter.
Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
The GED changes today for the first time in more than a decade. The new test is more expensive. You'll only be able to take it on a computer, no more paper. And the questions will apparently be harder and more aligned with the modern workplace. We know this test of so-called general educational development as a way to get the equivalent of a high school diploma. But the GED was never actually intended as a substitute for high school. It just sort of happened that way. Emily Hanford and Stephen Smith of American Radio Works tell us how the GED became the fallback option for millions of high school dropouts.
We're in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, at what looks like a typical high school commencement. But tonight's graduates aren't teenagers who just went to prom.
Most of them are adults. A lot of them have kids. A few are old enough to have grandkids.
I knew I had to get a high school diploma so that I can better myself.
I want to show to my son that no matter where you come from, you can work hard to succeed and be who you want to be.
I got my GED, and I posted it all over Facebook.
That was Sergio Hernandez, Tabitha Archuleta, and Jerry Spaulding. For the graduates here tonight, the GED is a second chance. Most colleges, employers, and government programs consider a GED equal to high school.
But the GED was never meant to be America's second chance diploma.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
During World War II, Congress lowered the draft age to 18. Some young men were drafted out of high school. By the time the war was over, about 16 million Americans had served.
The Queen Elizabeth, world's largest ocean liner, pulls into New York Harbor. Aboard are almost 15,000 happy GIs. These are the guys who helped win it for us against the Nazis.
And a lot of those guys wanted to go to college on the new GI Bill. Trouble was, many of them hadn't finished high school.
You couldn't send 21-year-olds that had been in Germany in the trenches. You aren't going to send them back into a regular high school. It just wasn't going to work.
H.D. Hoover is a retired University of Iowa professor.
The idea came along to say, okay, is there some way that we can give these people some kind of credential to get them into university?
What they came up with was the GED, a test designed to be easy, says Lois Quinn at the University of Wisconsin.
What the test did possibly was to weed out people who were functionally illiterate.
This type of standardized test was made possible by a technical innovation, says H.D. Hoover.
What we now know is the optical scanner.
Before the scanner, answer sheets had to be scored by hand. Now you could test millions of people a year at very low cost.
Social scientists created lots of standardized tests. William Reese is an education historian at the University of Wisconsin.
They were really quite convinced that there was a science of education, that learning could be measured. The GED has to be seen as, you know, a part of that larger story about how testing became so fundamental to American life.
The GED started as a program just for veterans. But in 1947, the state of New York allowed civilians to take the test. Eventually, every state did the same.
Demand for the GED grew.
But by the 1980s, the institution the GED was created for, the U.S. military, lost faith in the GED test.
From now on, the last word out of your mouth is sir. You understand?
Sir, yes, sir!
These recruits at a Marine training base in San Diego scrambled to obey the orders of a demanding drill instructor. Some of them won't make it in the military.
But what defense officials noticed is that people with GEDs were much more likely to quit or be thrown out than those with traditional high school diplomas.
First thing you do in the military after boot camp, you go to a classroom, and you have to listen to a teacher, and you have to interact with your peers.
This is Janice Lawrence of Temple University.
And so a high school diploma, it means we have some smarts and we know some stuff, but beyond that, it also means these whole behavioral ways of acting and functioning in society that the GED test doesn't take into consideration at all.
It's really hard to get into the military now if all you have is a GED.
But that hasn't stopped the popularity of the test. Today, 12% of all high school credentials issued in the United States are GED certificates. With Emily Hanford, I'm Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, we take a look at whether the new GED is actually testing the right things. We've all been there. You think you got the hottest video game for your kid or a friend who acts like one, but it turns out, no. So you gotta return it. Brace yourself. Holiday return policies are changing. They're stricter than they used to be, and many stores are giving you less time to bring things back for a refund. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the holiday return lowdown.
Best Buy, Sears, and Toys R Us have all cut back their return windows, and the return policies aren't usually displayed prominently. I visited a Best Buy store in Silver Spring, Maryland, where there were just a few small signs posted by the cash registers. Most of the customers I talked to didn't know what the return policy was, or that it's been cut in half from 30 to 15 days. When I told them, some got an unpleasant surprise, like Rose Accorda.
That's not good. I mean, especially in this very busy, fast-paced life we most live, I don't think 15 days is enough.
I asked the store manager whether the return policy should be better advertised. He pointed to a bigger sign spelling out the policy by the store entrance and said it's on the receipt. Also, Best Buy doesn't charge a restocking fee for returns in open boxes. And like many stores, it has an extended holiday return period.
You know, retailers are both naughty and nice.
Edgar Dworsky runs the Consumer World website.
They were being nice for the holiday shopping period. But as soon as that's over, they're going to the shorter period.
But Dworsky says retailers had to get stricter because they were losing billions on fraudulent returns, like when stolen merchandise is brought back for cash. Ken Perkins is president of Retail Metrics. He says fraud has been on the rise.
It certainly picked up during the Great Recession as things got worse. And, you know, it seems to be an ongoing issue that retailers are combating.
But there's still room for haggling. Stores might take something back after the return window has closed if you're patient enough to ask for the manager. Marlon Mendia manages the Best Buy I visited.
We were like, hey, I have a customer who bought a laptop and maybe they went out of the country and they're a few days outside the return. It's not a big deal for us. We can do those exceptions for our customers.
So be patient, be persistent, keep your receipts, and you might just have many happy returns. In Silver Spring, Maryland, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
52 passengers trapped on a ship in Antarctica for more than a week are finally on their way home. The rescue operation was international. A Chinese helicopter shuttled stranded passengers from a Russian ship to an Australian icebreaker. It sounds like all those countries are getting along, until it comes to their economic interests, Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
For a long time, there's been speculation about the natural resources buried under Antarctica. It's just speculation for a good reason. Frank Klotz is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
At the South Pole, the ice is over 9,000 feet thick. So even getting down to terra firma to find out whether or not there were minerals or resources there would be very difficult.
Klotz says the U.S. should keep a presence in Antarctica in order to maintain influence over how the continent is governed. Under an international treaty, Antarctica is kept as an icy lab for scientists. Ohio State University geologist Barry Lyons is headed to Antarctica next week.
The international cooperation is probably unique and a really good model for international cooperation.
But that international model cuts both ways. For example, the governing body in Antarctica works on consensus.
Their version of consensus is that everyone unanimously has to agree to a proposal for it to move forward.
Andrea Kavanaugh is with the Pew Charitable Trusts. She's been working to extend protections for the marine life around Antarctica because fishing boats are finding their local waters all fished out.
And that's why Antarctica has become a great new lucrative fishing ground.
The big prize in those waters is what we know as Chilean sea bass. Because of its high price per pound, fishermen call it white gold. Instead of cooperation, there's international competition to net the Antarctic fish. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Our final note on the show today is about a CEO of sorts who had a banner year, revitalizing a brand and essentially tripling business. Yeah, I'm talking about Pope Francis. True, the papacy is not a traditional executive role, but these numbers are pretty startling. Pope Francis drew more than 6.6 million people to his masses, audiences, and events in Vatican City from March 2013 until now. That contrasts with 2.3 million for Pope Benedict in all of 2012. I was there for Pope Francis's Palm Sunday Mass, crowds farther than I could see. All right, that's it for Marketplace from American Public Media. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.